1997. The study is from Sweden. In it, they exposed quiescent cells in vitro, that means in a petri dish, to a number of external mitogenic effectors, including a medium which they described as containing a relative excess of glutamine to the other 12 essential amino acids. Now, they achieved the excess by reducing the other 12 amino acids 100 to 1,000-fold, keeping glutamine in a normal concentration. In this test, they observed both DNA synthesis and mitosis, which is cell growth. My concern here is that this is a test done in a petri dish, and that the test used an excess of glutamine achieved by starving the cells of the other essential amino acids. And that's very different than the environment of a human body in the presence of a complement of amino acids, and in some cases, a possible deficiency of glutamine caused by a pathology like an autoimmune disease or something that damages the mucosa of the digestive system. Well, I spoke with Elizabeth Lipsky, the author of Digestive Wellness, who is a person that talks extensively about the use of glutamine. She also knows several people in the field, including the person who developed tube feeding, and everybody uses glutamine, you know, for the purpose of healing. In addition to that, she was concerned as well. So she did a Medline search, and she found conflicting research and none done specifically on human beings using high doses of glutamine for an extended period. You know, doses of up to 30 grams are often used, though, on cancer patients to protect their digestive tracts from chemotherapy and radiation. And there's been no indication of any sort of cancer exacerbation or cell growth like the study described. It may work differently in people than it does in vitro. And also, you want to remember that, again, they achieved the excess by starving the cells of the other essential amino acids, and that's different. Liz also then called Judy Schabert, who is an MD and a registered dietitian. She wrote the book on glutamine, which is called The Ultimate Glutamine, The Essential Non-Essential Amino Acids, a book published by Avery. It's a paperback. And they discussed the same thing. They had both seen the same study as the one Brzezinski sent me and had the same concerns I had with it. Liz and I, in discussing it, both felt that probably only high doses of glutamine should only be used as a supplement for a long period of time. If you're dealing with a patient with Crohn's or irritable bowel syndrome, and at the point where some healing has been achieved, you'd want to reduce the dose to about 1 or 2 grams a day. Now, this brings up the question of, are we beginning to use amino acids and natural occurring substances in our diet and in our bodies pharmaceutically? And this is a troubling question, and I've often wondered about, you know, the use of, for instance, smart drugs, you know, where they suddenly increase, you start taking huge amounts of certain amino acids to achieve a specific effect. And what I've been puzzling about, and Liz and I talked about it, is whether if you add in glutamine and it makes you feel good, whether you're getting a pharmacological effect. And what she said to me and what we discussed is that if it makes you feel better, it's likely that you're dealing with a glutamine deficiency. And that can happen from, like we said, autoimmune diseases. You know, so people, lupus, MS, autoimmune thyroiditis, because people with autoimmune disease have absorption problems. And in addition, if you've got food allergies, then you have gut absorption problems, and you may have a deficiency of glutamine. And what happens when you have a deficiency of glutamine is that the body pulls it from your muscle and your digestive system, which is precisely where you need it. So adding it in a deficiency and feeling an effect from it may indicate that there is a deficiency and there is some precedent for believing that that's so. In addition, remember that it's a very powerful nutrient for all cells and apparently cancerous ones as well. But what we have seen so far is no indication in the use by doctors of glutamine, in cancer patients, as I said, to protect them from chemo and radiation, of an exacerbation of the cancer or cancer growth. So, you know, as usual, I can't give you a definitive answer because there isn't one. And frankly, when people do give you a definitive answer, you should probably be concerned because none of us really knows for sure about anything. We do studies, we look at stuff, you do the best you can, and you always want to use some prudence. So if you are using glutamine and it's helping you, you know, when you can, reduce the dose down to maybe 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams, 1 or 2 grams a day as a maintenance if you have a condition that you know, suggests such a thing would be good for you. Many people do. Many people have had parasitic infections, anywhere where the, you know, mucosa is damaged. So that's the best I can tell you right now, and I hope that alleviates some anxiety. If I find out more, of course, I'll share that with you, as always. So what I want to get to now is talk about what I had promised to talk about this week, which is this whole issue of the sort of health challenges that occur in middle age. And again, keeping in mind that this may apply to people in their 30s, too, because there are some shifts that occur. And people experience these shifts at different times in their lives. There does seem to be a genetic difference between people. I think people are very individual. And I think not only are there genetic differences between people, but there are also differences in the way that we've been brought up and how we led our lives and how much sort of stress, not just in the normal sense, but even just wear and tear, we emotionally and physically have undergone as we've gone through life. I think what's important to remember when you're thinking about the processes that go on in your body and in your health and in your mind as you mature is that symptoms or things that occur often occur as a result of a cumulative effect. And this is something that I notice that people fail to understand. If you know, the simplest way to explain it is that if you lift weights, you know, I'm a proponent of weightlifting. I think it's, and I'll explain also why it's good for people as they age and what kinds of symptoms it helps to alleviate. But if you do something with exercise over a 10-year period and it doesn't cause you any particular discomfort during the 10-year period, and then suddenly you begin to develop some knee problems or some back problems or some foot problems or some shoulder problems, it may be that what's been going on is either in your exercise or in your work or in the car that you're driving and the bucket seat for your back and how is the shift for you or both legs the same, you know. These things have been accumulating and you've been reacting and adjusting to them the best way you can. And now you have some pain, but the pain isn't from what you did last week or even 2 weeks ago. In addition to that, fatigue patterns, a lot of this, some of it has to do with cumulative effects of how you've been leading your life. Now, doesn't mean that I want you to stand in front of the mirror and wag your finger at yourself and say, bad, you did these things, you know, should have been good, you shouldn't have done those things. That's not where it lives, because in addition to that, one of the things that I think people have a hard time accepting is that there's a whole raft of things that we don't have control over. We'd like to, but we don't. And part of the challenge, as I've been calling it, of maturing, I think, is learning to really accept the reality of who we are and use whatever we can, resources, to use these aspects of our experience as learning tools. This is very difficult because most people do not want to feel bad. And I think also that people are so used to sort of avoiding discomfort, particularly in this culture. We were brought up, especially those of us who are baby boomers, you know, in our mid to late 40s, we were brought up believing that if you felt uncomfortable or bad, that you took something for it, and both recreationally and medicinally. And to this day, we're bombarded with advertisements that say you don't have to suffer from hay fever and you don't have to have a headache and stuff. Of course, what we're learning now is that relieving symptoms, that there's a bill that you later end up with some kind of bill at the end, that anti-inflammatory medications and aspirin even are hard on the liver, whether you drink or not. And in addition, do cause damage to cartilage, which is, you know, in some cases the very thing you're trying to preserve when you're in pain or you have inflammation. So that's kind of disturbing. Ignoring the symptoms of an allergy and just covering up the symptoms again, is hard on the liver. And in addition, you know, any pharmaceutical has to be processed by the liver. So that's a stress. And in addition to that, it may be that the allergies are a symptom of some other greater need or something that needs to be addressed in your system. Or it may be that genetically your mom had allergies, or, you know, your mom had a thyroid problem, or you have, you know, this food allergies or whatever, and now, you know, you've inherited this trait and you live someplace with a lot of pollen. Some of this doesn't have to do with control over your situation. But whether you produced the situation on your own or whether you have experienced something that may be unfortunate. I mean, what about people who have become ill with chronic illnesses? They didn't ask for those situations. People with chronic fatigue didn't do something to make themselves sick, as far as we know. There's a trigger. But the question remains not whether you made it happen, but what are you going to do with it now that you're faced with it? And that's where the real work comes in. One of the problems with approaching middle age is that even if you've been vigorous and healthy all your life, now, you know, as one friend said it, now most of my time is spent, this is a middle-aged friend of mine, in maintenance. And she resents the fact that she has to spend, I mean, I think she's learning to live with it and enjoy it in a certain way, but initially there's this sense of, well, I don't want to have to pay attention to the stuff. I mean, I used to have to pay attention to it. Why do I have to do it now? And I think that part of what people lack is problem-solving skills around health. So what I was hoping to do today, I may go a little bit longer and give you a little less time to call in. Let me see if I can get through this all. But what I want to do is try to give you some problem-solving skills. You know, I'm not only trying to give you just straightforward information on this show, because information is slippery. What I'm trying to do is give you a capacity to do some of this for yourself. I think some of the things that are essential tools, if you haven't had, you know, any reason to have problem-solving skills develop in your life, if you've been lucky enough to feel well, is that the first thing you have to do is take charge. You don't want to put yourself in someone else's hands. That includes me or any other healthcare practitioner that you're in contact with. You don't want to respond in desperation by being willing to do anything. You have to, you know, you don't want to look for a quick fix because, you know, frankly, there is no sure fix for things. There's usually a whole array of things that are going on. It's usually more complicated. For those of you just tuning in, incidentally, I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I'm on KPFA FM speaking to you from the show Your Own Health and Fitness, which airs every Tuesday at 2, and today I'm speaking to you alone. I usually do an interview show, but once a month I come to you alone, and today I'm talking to you about the challenge, the health challenge of middle age. No quick fix, I'm sorry. And one of the metaphors I've been using with clients lately is, you know, I don't know, maybe this will sound dumb, but it came to me one day that it's as if existence is actually sort of a liquid substance, a rather viscous liquid substance. And like all substances that are liquid, the surface of it, when it's exposed to air, gets a little bit of a crust on it. And my experience is that most people run around on the crust, and this is not so easy to do because it's a fragile crust. But they attempt to do that. People rush around. They keep themselves very busy. They try to avoid feeling anything, you know. And some of this is simply because of economic problems, situations with their children, you know, being a breadwinner. There's a number of reasons why people end up in that state of mind. But for me, my experience is that the real existence, for me, in quotations, real existence, exists inside the liquid. And when something goes wrong, in quotes, with someone, they're often sort of thrust into the middle of this thing. And it's this thick liquid. Well, when you're in the middle of the liquid, all bets are off. I mean, you can't sort of put your thumb on something and expect it to stay stable. Everything is changing and flowing and globbing. And, you know, your state keeps changing. And you at some point have to begin to let go a little bit and become comfortable in the element. And that's part of what I think we face as we mature, is not trying to protect ourselves and be on the surface, but allow ourselves to exist in the midst of what's going on and become comfortable with the element of life. And that includes taking charge and being in charge of your health. And that means that you need to be able to put up with the fact that it changes and that there isn't a sure thing that someone can tell you that will always work, because your body will change. It will continue to change, and what may work at one point may not work later. So you have to sort of continue to keep an open mind One of my new friends is Clara Felix, you know, author of the Felix Letter, and she used the metaphor of being able to continue to let things in, being, as she said, a jar with the lid unscrewed and open so that there's room for things to come in, instead of aging and becoming rigid and closing the lid so that nothing can enter and you can't learn. What she said, from the perspective of 75 years, and a very active 75, apparently she looks quite a bit younger, is that wisdom works, that accumulating wisdom, becoming experienced with your situation and with life, is something you can pass on, and it's very rewarding. You're going to need some quiet time. I mean, I don't know any other way of becoming in contact with your, you know, embodied and getting in contact with an inner voice. You've got life and work choices to make. You know, you're not a victim. You want to make choices both in your life and also in terms of what kind of a practice or therapy you use to maintain yourself well, because of a sense of resonance. And you don't want to sort of completely marry anything. And this speaks again to the liquid quality of things and the fact that things change for you. What I'm trying to say is that taking care of yourself is the same as having quality of life. That developing a loving attitude toward yourself is really the way to deal with the challenges of things not being the same and not always being the way you want. And I think that men and women respond to the challenge of this issue of needing to become self-protective and self-nurturing in a different way. I think that men and women have very different problems with it. I think that men have had less opportunities to take care of themselves, less lessons, because their bodies don't constantly change the way women's do, although women ignore their symptoms as well. But men are, you know, still in many, not all cases, women are very much the breadwinner as well now, but men have been socialized and brought up to believe that they're the breadwinner, and they feel a lot of pressure from that. They're used to not asking directions because they don't want to expose weakness. I'm being very general here, and I apologize for that, but I'm trying to make a point. I think it's hard to ask for help. I think men and women share that. Men, I think, are trained into ignoring pain and bullying through. Again, this is true of women as well. What I see happening to men in middle age that goes back to this issue of cumulative effect is men, I think, tend to suddenly present with a lot of orthopedic pain. Suddenly their knees, their backs are bothering them. And I think that one of the things that's really critical for men as they approach the middle part of their lives is to use exercise that is regular instead of doing the sort of weekend blowout. That consistency and finding an appropriate level, which may be different from day to day, and this speaks back to needing to be a little bit more sensitive to your feelings. You know, another way to think about it is that if you're not sensitive to the way you feel, if you don't develop some quality of listening and sensitivity, that in the end you're going to sort of be stopped in your tracks. Not everybody gets sick, but in, you know, as things change in your life, if you accomplish this, if you become more familiar with your territory, you're less likely to get a big surprise. It doesn't mean surprises won't happen, but you're less likely to end up with knee surgery if you've been watching over a period of time how you exercise and how you feel. So some of the issues around back and knee and stuff, these are cumulative things that have occurred from either using or not using your body. It can work both ways, but there are sort of postural and movement re-education things that can occur. But regular exercise is absolutely critical for men in midlife, and it should be, doesn't need to be much. It can be a small amount of exercise. This also, weightlifting particularly, if you're doing shorter workouts, if you're giving yourself enough time for recovery, helps to, this is for both sexes an advantage, it helps to increase the testosterone in your body, and men as they approach middle age tend to not lose testosterone but to gain estrogen. We live in an estrogenic environment, and this seems to be why men become sort of softer and feel less of a testosterone sort of effect. It's mostly because they're picking up some of the estrogenic effects of aging and the environment. And weightlifting can help to mediate that effect, as well as eating a little more protein, which we find everybody needs as they age, and not eating sugar. Sugar causes a lot of inflammation and can, you know, eventually give people an arthritic condition. It also changes your gut and reduces immunity. For everyone, digestive enzymes and taking probiotics like acidophilus, it really helps people's digestion sort of slows down a little bit sometimes in middle age. And everybody can get some benefit usually from some digestive enzymes. The main thing with men, I think also, and women as well, is when you're doing weightlifting, to remember that you're dealing with a benefit, and if you overdo it, you're also dealing with a problem with producing more stress hormones and also stressing your adrenals. So although exercise regulates the hormones for both sexes, if you do too much, you're likely to feel better shortly, you know, immediately because of an adrenaline surge, and then later be very, very tired because of the stress and the stress hormones. And there are ways of working with that, like making sure that you cool down appropriately afterwards. Women tend to self-blame a lot when they don't feel good. They tend to become very depleted. They tend to feel that they have to mommy everybody in the world. In addition, I'm always very brokenhearted to find that women have a very poor body image. And I always think when I see a woman who's maybe 40, who actually looks quite lovely, that she's not getting an opportunity to enjoy being young while she's young. You know, it's very important to enjoy what you have instead of focusing on what you're losing. You try to enjoy what you've got. There's a lot of choices for women in this period hormonally, and I think you already know if you've been listening to the show that I'm concerned, because what I'm seeing is that it's even if you need estrogen, it's not really prudent to take estrogen your whole life. What we're finding now is that it is very tumor-promoting, and so if it's imprudent to take it your whole life, if you're putting yourself at risk, the question comes up of whether you should take it at all, because if you stop taking it, you're likely to start having some menopausal symptoms later. In other words, it may just delay things. I do like the use of natural progesterone. It is not a panacea. There are still symptoms, and people, as they approach menopause, will approach it at a different time and very differently. You'll find possibly that from month to month it's different every time, and that you need to experiment with things like maybe just before what would normally be your period, whether it's regular or not, that you need a little extra progesterone during the 7-day period toward the end of your cycle. You know, maybe you're getting headaches and a little extra natural progesterone can help with that. So there are herbs, there's homeopathy. What you can count on in menopause is that what may give you relief at one point may not give you relief later, so you may have to keep changing, and this speaks back to the issue of needing to be sensitive to your symptoms. When you're using herbs and homeopathy, you need to notice what kind of a subtle effect is occurring in your body and become more acquainted with the cycles that you're going through. A lot of women in menopause need extra thyroid, and that is something you can take for a short period of time to sort of boost yourself up a little bit if you're testing just a bit low in thyroid. And then later, after menopause, a lot of women do level out and sometimes don't need to take a small supplemental dose of thyroid after that. And that can, you can take thyroid out slowly. You can remove it slowly. There are dietary issues that help with all of this. Nothing's going to take all the symptoms away without there being a price. So one of the things I think I also urge women when they're facing menopausal issues to think about is that this is a passage, and it's a temporary passage for most of us now. I can't say for everyone that, you know, I can say, well, you know, don't try not to take estrogen, but you know, there may be a woman who is having terrible vaginal atrophy and terrible low estrogen symptoms and may test low for estrogen. What I'm trying to say is pay attention to all the literature and look at some of the other choices that may be available and try other things first. And if you do estrogen, try to use as little as possible. I think that the idea that we can completely remove all the symptoms and feel good as we age is a dangerous one, because I think that these are passages and I think that things change. I don't think that the bad symptoms of menopause necessarily continue postmenopausally. Again, it's going to be different for you. Last couple of things that Clara said to me from 75, one of my favorites, is she said, the time I used to spend being pretty, I use being wise. So, you know, remember that you can't expect to get all the answers. You're going to get pieces of things and you're going to piece things together. But what Clara Felix says from 75, from her perspective, is that when you look back, the pieces fit together. There's some order to it. There really is. So You know what? I am going to open up the phone lines now. I don't need to keep yammering away because I'm sure you have specific things you want to talk about, and I'd like to invite you to participate. It's your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm going to open up the phone lines now. 510-848-4425. Again, 510-848-4425. Remember to turn your radio down before we take you. This is KPFA. We're going to take a brief musical break and come back with your phone calls. Welcome back. This is your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I'm here with you live on KPFA every week, Tuesdays at 2. I'm doing a show on the challenges of middle age in terms of health, and I'm inviting you to participate in the show by calling now at 510-848-4425. Remember to keep trying if you're not getting through. Just keep trying. Lines will open up. And also turn down your radio so we don't get feedback. Let's move to our first caller. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Caller?
Oh, hello?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I have to turn down the radio. I wanted to know, this kind of goes back to your glutamine subject, if that's all right.
Sure.
I've had colon cancer and half of my colon removed.
Right.
And, that's 15 years ago. And so I have questions about, this, whether or not I'm one of those people who it may be indicated to, take glutamine, and anything else you have to offer about, how that would affect your absorption. And
well, I'm not a doctor, so I can't really give you an answer. What I can tell you is that you may want to refer back to the book Digestive Wellness by Elizabeth Lipsky, because you'll have a whole raft of different things to look at.
Okay. On my list.
And then you're telling me that you've had part of your colon actually removed.
Right,
yes?
About close to half of it.
Are you having symptoms? Are you having a lot of digestive symptoms?
Not really, but I have some sort of autoimmune kind of history and things going on as well.
So a lot of food allergies?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, it's what I think I was saying is that there's some risk involved in almost anything we do. What you might do is try taking 1 to 2,000 milligrams a day on an empty stomach before meals and see what happens. See what happens to your energy and your sensation in your stomach and stuff and in your digestive system and see whether you feel differently. If it makes you feel a lot better, you might want to try doing that for a while, but you may want to let your doctor know that you're doing that as well.
One other question. Is that the same as glucosamine sulfate? Or is
No. Glucosamine sulfate is an entirely different substance.
Okay.
And it's used for, it helps to feed the joints. It helps to retain and repair cartilage, we hope.
Uh-huh. All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Incidentally, for those of you who heard that, I think the glucosamine hydrochloride is a better way of taking glucosamine. The sulfite is a little more expensive, and my experience has been that the hydrochloride seems to work a little better, too. Let's move to another caller. You're on the air with KPFA. Caller. We got a caller there. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm a person in my early 40s, and I've been experiencing bleeding, like menstrual bleeding, for the past 3 months, and I had this once before a couple years ago.
Well, wait a minute. You're in your 40s, and
yeah.
You're having a menstrual period, and you didn't before or something? Why?
No, I did before. In other words, I'm having a lot of bleeding, an ongoing period for 3 months.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, you need to see a doctor. I mean,
I've just gotten a lot of conflicting information.
Okay.
And I wondered if...
What are they telling you?
Well, when they looked at me, I was normal. My cells were normal. They suggest progesterone.
Yes.
Which I'm taking.
Are you taking it orally or on your skin?
Now I'm taking both, and I'm taking... a homeopathic progesterone,
that's a good idea.
A synthetic.
Right. Well, the only thing I'm wondering about is I'm not sure that the oral... You're talking about a pill for the oral progesterone?
Yes, along with the Progest.
I understand. And is the pill you're taking natural progesterone, or is it the Provera?
It It's natural.
Okay.
I can tell you the name.
Well, no, it's okay. What I'd be concerned about is that what I've been reading and what I understand is that it works. It's less effective to take natural progesterone, although it's important to take the natural progesterone, but it's less effective to take it in a pill form because it has to go through your liver. So using it on the skin tends to be better. There's also an oil that you can order from Raymond Pete in Oregon.
Okay.
And I don't have his P.O. box, but if you call the front desk, they can look back on one of the sheets from when he was on and give you his P.O. box. And
okay.
He sells a natural progesterone oil that you can use in your mouth and let it, just hold it in your mouth and let it dissolve. So, and it's about a 16th of a teaspoon of his oil is about 25 milligrams. You may find that if you space your doses out a little bit, you want to make sure also that you're not overdosing in the early part of your cycle. So I would kind of check in with your doc. The only thing I would change is maybe trying to use a different form of, because the oil, his oil in particular, is not micellized.
Uh-huh.
It's just an oil, and what happens is it will be absorbed into the mucosa in your mouth, so it doesn't go through your liver.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that on the skin, or either in his particular oil, again, not a micellized progesterone, you may get a better effect. Have you noticed a difference since you started using the progesterone?
Well, I'm very athletic, and I've just continued swimming and weightlifting and running, and I've heard that weightlifting actually, if you have a tendency to bleed a lot, you may bleed more.
I've never heard that, but I am concerned about whether or not you're doing too much exercise and maybe not fueling yourself properly with food. So another thing you have to look at when you're looking at your hormones is your diet and your activity level. So you may want to think about either talking to someone else or talking to me another time,
okay,
you know, calling me at my office or something, because you do need some individual attention, and there is some concern about overdoing it and balancing these things out.
Okay, well, I'll try to give you a call
okay.
when I can talk to you.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Good luck.
Bye.
Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air. Can you go
Hi.
Ahead, please?
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm 55 years old. I used to be very physically active until about 15 years ago, and I just basically stopped. In that period of time, I've gained about 50 pounds, and I noticed that I became weak and had no endurance. I was also smoking heavily.
So are you surprised now?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you surprised?
Oh, no, I'm here.
Okay.
And so I finally succeeded in giving up smoking about
Good.
5 months ago.
Good for you.
And then the next thing was that I'm weak and overweight.
Yes.
And so I've been trying to go out and walk 4 to 5 days a week. And my walks consist, I alternate a flat land walk and a walk over the hills behind where I live.
Okay.
And they last between 35 minutes and 2 hours.
I'd be careful about the 2 hours. If you can get to a point where you're building up to that slowly and you're not experiencing any fatigue at all, that might be okay. But it's not necessary to do 2 hours. And 45 minutes to an hour is sufficient.
And what about flat land versus hills?
There's nothing wrong with doing the hill, because what you're going to do when you go uphill is get yourself a little out of breath, which won't burn fat, but it will help to produce more endurance and build more muscle.
Right.
It'll help work your cardiovascular system. The trick with walking uphill is when you come back down, it's hard on your knees and your hips.
Right, and that's what my intention is, to strengthen my knees.
Well, not by walking downhill fast.
Oh,
so.
I've been noticing my pace. I haven't hurt my knees at all.
Good for you.
I've been doing this for
Good for
4
you.
Weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
But what I noticed was I had to go out of town, and I broke my program for about 4 or 5 days. I'd been chronically sore before that, and after a break of 5 days, I came back. I keep track of the time, not that I race. And all of a sudden, everything became easier.
All right, all right.
4 or 5 days off, and I guess my question
is,
what's the proper role and timing in this? I assume you need to heal in between these hours.
Okay, well, first of all, there isn't a blanket answer to that question for everybody. It's going to be individual. And what I'm wondering about is whether it's possible for you to sort of stop monitoring it as if you were this peak performance athlete and allow yourself to respond to how you're feeling a little bit, keeping in mind that, like I said earlier, that there's a, you know, when you say to me, I've been walking for 4 weeks and my knees are okay, remember I said it can take 10 years before you have pain in your knees.
Oh, No, my feet. Well, I played ice hockey and damaged my knees quite a bit in college and high school, and so I've been very sensitive to keeping my knee, my leg muscles strengthened around my knees and watching them for signs of anything. But I don't know. I guess I'm a man, and so I look at the stopwatch. I see how many times I have to stop on my way to the top of the 600-foot hill behind.
Because you like seeing progress, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Well,
okay.
I have seen progress.
All right.
But I want to do everything. I want to feel like I'm 20, of course. That's
right.
Absurd.
Well, you know, I think what you ought to do is be grateful that you can walk, and that you're able to do it, and you're getting a training effect, and really put your attention on that, and also put your attention on the way that your particular body is responding in training, and that at your age, after laying off for so long, your body is responding to this. In terms of a long layoff, consistency is the key with exercise. It's absolutely the key.
Well, how many days a week for how long would you suggest?
Again, that's going to depend on how you feel as you're doing it. 4 days or 5 days is probably fine. Now, you might want to consider eventually getting on a weightlifting program that's not excessive,
uh-huh.
You know, an easy one, and adding that in, and then you can reduce your walking to maybe 4 days a week or even three.
Because I also want to lose the 50 pounds.
Well, you have to build muscle in order to lose weight because it speeds your metabolism up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You also have to stop eating sugar. And you have to get some protein throughout the day so you're not craving sugar.
Yeah, well, smoking was first, exercise second, and I'm trying to pay attention to
Well, you're on the right track.
But I've got actually just one last question.
Okay, very quick, because we have other callers waiting.
I've decided that it probably, based on my knees, it would not be a good idea for me to run until I've lost about 20 or 30.
You may not need to run. In terms of losing weight and maintaining leanness and all of that, walking works really quite well because when you get out of breath, you're really burning sugar, not fat.
And how fast the heart rate should I try to...
Don't worry about your heart rate. You're not supposed to get out of breath or be puffing or anything if you want to burn fat.
Okay.
I'd rather see you do that kind of effort in a gym where you're building muscle and adding some lean body mass to you so that your metabolism speeds up. We want to kick your metabolism back up.
Okay.
So we don't want to fatigue you in the process. We want it to be more gentle.
Uh-huh. Do you consult about these things?
You bet.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Good luck. Okay. That was a sort of an example of what happens sometimes when people lay off for a long time and they come back and it's like da-da-da-da-da. You know, they're kind of... You have to take it easy. You have to kind of build up slowly. Let's get another caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with KPFA.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, for the woman that had the bleeding problem.
Yes.
I just came through menopause, and I had the same thing exactly. And what helped me, as a matter of fact, what fixed me, nettle tincture to stop the bleeding and Vitex to regulate the pineal gland. And there's a little booklet that you can get in most health food stores that have books, like Real Food Company or something, called Vitex, the Woman's Herb, and it shows the companion herbs for different problems. So I had to call in and mention that.
Okay, the reason that I don't tell people stuff like that on the air is because she's taking quite a bit of progesterone, and that's a good first step. If she takes Vitex at the same time, it may throw the balance off of what she's doing. So I like people, if they're going to take herbs, to at least do one consultation with an herbalist.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But she should check the book, and nettle is...
I'd rather have her see an herbalist, if that's
because
the route.
Because nothing, well, if she can, but it's nothing like bleeding forever.
Well, nettles may not work for her. But anyway, it's an interesting suggestion, and
yes,
I appreciate your call.
Yes, it helped me, and I wanted to share it.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Let's get another caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Lena Berman.
Yes, hi. I really appreciate your show. I'm going to turn the radio down a little bit. I listen to your show every chance I get. I have one comment to make that might be a good training tip for people that do a lot of running or cycling, and I also have a question. The tip that I have for people who do running or cycling is in the context that you raised about cumulative damage to knees and things like that or other parts of your body that you don't feel happening at the time. I see a lot of people training who go out on a cool weather kind of day that's cold enough to wear a sweatshirt, but they wear shorts. And
so you're talking about the stress on the body of heating up and cooling down fast.
Well, yes, yeah. But also what the tip I had to offer about knee damage in the future is that if it's cold enough to keep your arms and your upper body covered with a sweatshirt, it's cold enough to keep your knees
warm.
Protected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot
yeah, warming up slowly also is very important.
Well, yeah, that's right. And it's stretching. A gradual thing. Yeah. Otherwise, you can do damage. But
you bet.
But the thing, or if you ride like too much distance without preparation.
Oh, well, you have to train. You can't yeah. just go for broke. What was your question?
Well, okay. The other thing, what I was going to say about the warming is that you can find in drugstores a mustard plaster, kind of a stick-on thing that you can put on your legs if you like the freedom of movement without long clothes, and it does keep your knees warm. The question I have is that I got something in the mail called, it's a magazine that sort of advertises something called Brave New Cures by some doctor, and he's talking about reversing high blood pressure. And
any time I see an ad where they make a claim like a Brave New Cure, I go running in the opposite direction.
Well, he does. The reason I'm attracted to it is he talks about diabetic, and I am a diabetic, and you know, he talks about that there are very good things possibly without insulin. But the other thing is, he definitely seems to be appealing to something in people that's like this need for immortality, and I think that's a lack of wisdom.
Well, I think what I just spent quite a bit of time talking about is that in my experience and in the experience of people who are quite a bit older than I am also, who conferred with me about all of this, there isn't a brave new cure. Life is not like that. There isn't. I mean, you can reduce symptoms, but there isn't a sort of this is it, as far as I can tell. I mean, I think we saw a this is it sort of mentality in the Heaven's Gate people. and that's fine. I mean, maybe they're very happy. I don't know, but I think that that it's like I said before, it's more like that liquid substance. Things change and your body adapts. Diabetes, the important thing about diabetes is your diet has to really be monitored carefully. And in addition to that, exercise is absolutely critical for diabetics. And weightlifting as well. It's very profound.
Yeah, I've already experienced something pretty dramatic.
Okay.
I really had way elevated blood sugar
okay.
for days and days and days. And I just decided one day I just took an 18-mile bicycle ride and one afternoon.
Okay, but that's an example of something else I've been cautioning people about, which is not to go for all or nothing, but to train slowly into things and really
yeah.
listen. Listen, we need to let some other people get a chance. So
right.
thank you so much for your call and your comments. Do we have another caller on the line here? We have some lines open at 510-848-4425 if you want to jump in. It's your own health and fitness with health integration specialist Lena Berman talking about the health challenges of middle age. We have lines open. Let's get a caller on the line. You're on the air with your own health and fitness. Go ahead, caller.
Is it me?
Yes.
Hi. Oh, I just wanted to say, based on what the previous caller was saying, that the Brave New Cure is advertised by Dr. Whitaker. So.
Okay. Well, thanks for that.
Sure.
Okay. Can we get another caller on the line? Caller, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, caller.
Hi. I was wondering, as you age, at what rate have there been studies that show at what rate that people lose aerobic capacity?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because there's a kind of myth about aging, which is that you, I don't know the exact answer to your question, but I'm going to respond to it in a more roundabout way. One of the things that goes along with this, you lose your aerobic capacity, is that you gain fat when you age. And in fact, what happens is that people's recovery rate slows down. And that may speak to the issue of aerobic capacity as well. So what happens is not that we don't have the ability to continue to grow muscles or to continue to challenge our cardiovascular systems, but it means that it requires more rest and more recovery time to do that. So that means that just practically speaking, you're going to be training a little less hard and a little less often and with more rest built in. On the other hand, if you continue to work out your whole life, what happens is that you don't put on a lot of fat because there's no reason why that has to happen. It's really just a process of becoming less active or your diet becoming. And this is frequently because people are tired or achy, and exercise can help. So, I know people I have a friend whose father's in his 80s and he swims in races and wins. Now, he is swimming against other people who are in their 70s and 80s. So he is slower than he was in his 40s, but he's still out there.
And one quick question. Orthopedically, you said as men age, they tend to, drag into your office or orthopedics office with orthopedic problems.
Mm-hmm.
And as I age, I want to try and avoid that. I'm
yes.
already actually experienced some of that. But How much do you really need to get your heart rate up? I mean, I like to go for a 45-minute or an hour nice hike and walk, and I really am not fixated on my pulse and stuff.
Right.
I can feel my heart rate up a little bit, but I'm not panting.
Very good question.
And is that going to be good enough for me?
Well, it depends on what you want to do. I mean, what I always say about training is that it's the same rules as when you're designing something. It's form follows function. So how you want your body to function is how you train it. If what you want to do is race, then you're going to need to do things that challenge your lung capacity where you're out of breath. If what you want to do is be able to go for long hikes and stay lean and feel good, then what you're doing is fine. You know, I did notice at some point when I started using walking as an exercise versus swimming, which is what I used to do, and some running, that I didn't have the same lung capacity. But in your hikes, you know, some of the time you're walking uphill, you'll get the same benefit. So I think it's absolutely essential that you do what you like and that you remember that you're training your body to perform what you want it to do, and you can change your mind and do something different at another time.
Okay, thanks so much.
Good luck with that. Sounds great.
Thanks.
Let's get another caller on the line. Caller, go ahead, please. You're on KPFA.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm a woman of 50, and I'm very athletic, and I'm right in the middle of menopause also. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I've noticed that different parts of my body, the connective tissue of different parts of my body seems to be really sensitive.
Yeah.
For instance, my knees were really sensitive for a year or so.
Right. That's a menopausal symptom.
Yeah, and that moves around. Is there anything I can do?
Well, you know, that's a tough one because I'm 47, and I'm starting to have a little bit of that happening, and it kind of surprised me because I've been able... I'll tell you, what I think works the best is, obviously, you want to kind of notice... I noticed that, for instance, there were times, like I was saying earlier, that I needed a little extra progesterone.
Okay.
So I added in a little extra progesterone during that week before, technically, my period, you know, before the period sort of...
Right.
And that also seemed to mitigate some of the headachy stuff, which I never used to have. And I suddenly started feeling sort of slight headachy stuff. And that sort of helped with that.
I have that slightly, too.
Yeah. There's a million menopausal symptoms. It's like if you read the symptoms, you think, shoot me now. You know, just before I get out of bed, don't even let me go to that place. But the sort of revolving achiness, the thing that I have noticed that works the best, I mean, there's obviously the omega-3 fatty acids, the fish oils, are absolutely phenomenal for that.
I'll try.
And primrose oil is very good also because it has GLA, which reduces inflammation and helps with hormonal stuff. So I think taking a couple of large capsules of primrose, and I really like the primrose the best for this, the 1,300 milligrams a couple times a day, and then one of the fish oil caps, the big ones, 1,000 milligrams. Taking them together, though, because you want to have more of the omega-3s in your diet, slightly higher than the omega-6s, and you want to make sure you're taking at least 4, and you can take as much as 8 IUs of vitamin E, unless there's a problem with your clotting. You don't want to get your blood too thin with too much vitamin E, but at least 400 if you're taking fish oils and primrose oil. The other thing that's absolutely essential is to continue to do gentle forms of stretching
and
things like somatic, you know, exercises and whatever you choose to do, that you keep doing those. And I think that those help. I do think those things help.
Okay, great. Well,
good
thank
luck.
You very much.
Keep up the good work.
Bye-bye.
Let's get another caller on. Caller, you're on KPFA.
Hi, I had a question about thyroid. I've heard you and other people also talking about the standard blood tests not catching all cases of underactive thyroid.
Yeah.
What tests do work? How do you tell them?
Well, you know, keeping in mind, again, that I'm not an endocrinologist or a doctor, what I have noted, and it could change, they keep upgrading the tests, is the things that I've heard recommended is to order at least a T3 by RIA.
RIA?
Yeah, and then the TSH... The best form of a TSH test, which is the thyroid circulating hormone, which is the one they like to take alone, which doesn't always tell you much, is there's a test that's a third generation. It's under the category of ultra-sensitive, but it's a third generation, so it's a very sensitive TSH. And then you also want to find out what the total T4 is, because you want to know what the relationship between the T3 and the T4 are. The other thing is that people who have inflammation in the thyroid gland, which can be the presence of antibodies, which is a very common condition. It's remarkably common. will often test normal when they test their thyroid levels. But if you do an antibody test, and there are two different kinds of tests for microchromosomal antibodies, then you'll notice some antibodies. And if that is the case, then the treatment now is to put people on replacement thyroid to reduce the swelling in the gland, to quiet it down, and give people a consistent level of thyroid. Mm-hmm. It's very common.
Do you have anything you recommend reading that would have more detail?
Oh, boy. That's so hard, you know. It's, I mean, Ray Peet's books speak to some of this. I'm going to have him on again, I think. I've asked him to come on again for our next pledge drive, and he's got a new book on this, so we'll probably talk about it. But there isn't a lot of information about this. It's difficult, too. It's frustrating. Let me think about it. If I think of something, I'll announce it during an editorial. But I don't know of any books.
I don't get to listen to your show every week.
Yeah.
Any means,
one thing that is a good publication to read in general, to just keep up on what's going on with alternative medicine, is the Townsend Letter out of Port Townsend Help. What is it? Port Townsend, Washington. Yes, thank you. Ugh, God, my brain. They're listed, not in the 800 directory, but at the front desk they always have a sheet, and on the sheet I list their address. And that's a very, very useful publication. It's a large magazine, and it keeps you in touch with all the latest research in alternative medicine. Okay?
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I don't know. One quick one? All right. Let's get another person on very quickly. Caller, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you could recommend the best books on basic nutrition and health.
Yeah, that's a hard one, you know. I like Robert Crahone's book, Nutrition Made Simple, but, oh, God, there are people who like so many different... I would just peruse the books and see what resonates for you, because, you know, what I like isn't going to be the same as what you like, and it's all changing all the time. I mean, I tend to like the stuff on... Well, Robert's book is pretty balanced, because it leaves room for a lot of different things there, you know. So that might be a place to start. It's the name is Robert Crahone's Nutrition Made Simple. So
okay.
Yeah. I hope it works for you.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Bye.
I think we have to stop. All right, so what's going to happen is next week I am going to have, I hope I'm going to have Dr. Effie Chow on. She's an acupuncturist and a Qigong master. She's been a Qigong master for 30 years. She's also got a PhD and an RN. She's quite an accomplished woman. She's co-authored a book called Miracle Healing from China, Qigong, and I'm hoping to have her next week. I want to thank Jan Michaels for running the board today and remind those of you who've been listening and may want to get a copy of the show that you can get copies of all of my shows, this one included, by calling my office at 707-769-1458. Again, my number is 707-769-1458, and if people need to get hold of me, you can do that as well. I'd appreciate it if people would call during normal business hours. You can also get a list of other available shows by sending me a business-size, self-addressed stamped envelope. Send that to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. And remember, information about the show is always at the front desk or past shows. If you're confused about a health show you've heard and you don't know if it's mine, call the front desk and have them look in the binder with my shows listed. All right, so I'll be back next week with Dr. Effie Chow, we hope. And this is Lena Berman. This has been your own health and fitness talk show on KPFA 94.1 FM. See you next week.